Reading further infuriated the French government by comparing its Roma policy to actions of the Nazis. French President Nicolas Sarkozy then suggested Reading's native Luxembourg should take the migrants. Commission President José Manuel Barroso is trying to tamp down the acrimony.
Expressions used in the heat of the moment may have given rise to misunderstandings.
Reading has now acknowledged there shouldn't be parallels drawn between France and Nazi Germany. And though Sarkozy made no comment as he arrived for the summit, he's unlikely to hold his tongue inside. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Hurricane alerts are in effect on Mexico's eastern Gulf Coast, with Hurricane Carl now on the way. The storm has already unleashed torrential rains on the Yucatan Peninsula as it moved toward the Gulf of Mexico, where it is expected to grow. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Who is Don Draper, and what's happened to him this season on Mad Men? On the next Fresh Air, we ask John Hamm. And we talk with Hamm about his role as an FBI agent in Ben Affleck's new crime drama, The Town. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from the Spurlock Museum Guild, presenting When in Rome, its annual auction and buffet dinner on Friday, September 24th at the I Hotel in Champaign. Preview at 5:30 with dinner at 6:30, followed by the auction. Proceeds support the museum's educational programs. Information at 607-1370.
Welcome to Focus on WILL AM. This is Carol Spindell, your guest host. The producer of this program is Harriet Williamson, and our technical director is Jason Croft. The interview today has been pre-recorded, so we will not be able to take calls from listeners. Our guest today is an entomologist and a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. He has spent his professional life studying, among other things, the interactions between insects and plants. In his 2007 book, Bringing Nature Home, he lays out a scientific justification for why American gardeners should grow native plants and the very important role suburban gardens and yards can play in preserving our ecosystems and saving our wildlife. Professor Tallamy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much, Carol. Happy to be here.
We're delighted to have you. Now, you say in your preface, the wild creatures we enjoy and would like to have in our lives will not be here if we take away their food and the places they live. But most of us don't want to take away the food and places to live for wild things. We support the preservation of parks and refuges. We like to go there and hike and canoe and see wildflowers when they bloom in the spring. We like to watch birds. But we don't connect those places and those activities with what we grow in our own backyards. And when we go to a nursery or a garden center to buy plants for our gardens, most of the plants for sale were imported at some point in time from other continents. Now, you didn't make this connection initially either. What changed your thinking?
Well, actually, we moved into a new home on a plot of land that had been mowed for hay before we moved in. And when they started to build, they stopped mowing. And the plants that came back had been the ones that were there as rootstocks that were mowed, and they were all the invasive alien plants that we have in this area, multiflora rose and oriental bittersweet and Japanese honeysuckle and autumn olive. And it was literally a jungle in our backyard and front yard, and in order to move around, I had to cut trails just so I could get to where I wanted to go. And I am an entomologist, so when I go through vegetation, I'm always looking at the vegetation to see what has been eaten and what hasn't. Where are there little holes? Because that's a clue that there's something interesting there, and then I turn over the leaf and see what it is. So one day, shortly after we moved in, I was doing that, and I noticed a distinct pattern that on things like black cherry and black oak and walnut and the native plants that belong here, there was the typical load of insect damage with some interesting things chewing on the leaves. But on Japanese honeysuckle and autumn olive and multiflora rose and Oriental Bittersweet in particular, Bradford pear, absolutely no damage at all. And it just occurred, just struck me right then that, well, of course, our insects can't eat these plants because they evolved outside of the food web of these insects. And insects are very particular about what they can eat because they have to have had a chance to evolve adaptations to get around plant defenses. And that takes long periods of evolutionary time. So this is really standard plant-insect interaction theory that we learned back in the 70s. Although we weren't talking about invasive plants or alien plants, we were simply talking about what plants insects were adapted to eat and which ones they weren't. So it took me 20 years to actually put what I had learned in grad school together into some kind of a practical way, and I realized that this is a huge problem of invasive species that really hadn't been talked about very much. And that's how it started. And then I realized it hadn't been talked about at all for the most part, and there was some research to be done, and that's what got the ball rolling.
Uh-huh. Now, this book is really a work of persuasion. You want gardeners to change what we plant in our gardens. And I have to wonder, as a scientist, is that a departure for you to write a persuasive book?
Oh, yes, it's a departure for me to write a book at all. But, you know, it happened, it wasn't the book first. I started to do, after I made that observation in our backyard, we set up some undergraduate projects, and people got wind of what we were doing, and there was immediate interest about it. So I started being asked by Audubon groups and Master Gardener groups to give talks on this. And I did that for, probably 2 years. And I got a feel for the questions people were asking, what they understood, what they didn't understand. And one of the things they always said is, I want to read something about this. Can you give us something to read? Well, there wasn't anything to read. So, 2 years of saying no, I finally said, well, I'll write a pamphlet. So the pamphlet turned into the book. But it was stimulated by people saying, I really want to read more about this. So the departure is real, but it was more or less demanded by the public saying, we want to know what's going on. And that's the first time in my 30 years of research that anybody actually wanted to know what I was working on. So I took advantage of that.
Well, it really requires those of us who have yards and gardens to change our mindset. I mean, we tend to think the more exotic something is, the more beautiful it is. And as you become more skilled as a gardener, you want to grow new and different plants.
Well, this is the big mistake that we've made over the years. Somehow we came to think of plants only as ornaments. And it's not that they're not beautiful, and it's not that we can't use them in ornamental ways, but plants are vital to every ecosystem on this planet. They are the first trophic level. They capture the sun's energy and create the food for everything that's on this planet. With a few minor exceptions at the bottom of the ocean next to sulfur vents, there are different food webs down there. But they're playing such a vital role in supplying energy for everything else that to treat them only as ornaments is to really mistreat them and to mistreat ourselves. Now, if we were doing this in just a tiny area, it wouldn't matter. But you look at the size of the human footprint, and every place we've gone, we're landscaping in almost an identical way. We have vast areas of lawn, so we removed most of the plants, first of all. And then the plants we put back typically are from Asia or Europe. And they are not part of our food webs. They do a very poor job at transferring energy to other organisms. And when people hear statistics like the fact that our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects, not fruits or seeds or berries, they rear them on insects. 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. And if the insects disappear, we're going to lose 96% of our birds. Of course, if insects disappear, we're going to lose everything because they're such vital components of food webs and other parts of the ecosystem. So we can't afford to cut off their food supply because food webs across the land will collapse. And that is exactly what we're doing in our giant suburban ecosystems.
Well, we think about how much of our landscape is paved. I think that's something we're becoming more aware of now, about impervious structures and how we need to go toward more pervious structures. But I don't know if we do think about what a large percentage of our landscape is in lawn.
Yeah. Last figure I saw was 45.6 million acres. It's increasing by 600 square miles a year. It's more than eight times the size of New Jersey is lawn right now. And personally, I think that's an underestimate.
Huh.
It's, you know, you just drive around and look at the spaces. Look at intersections of roads where, you know, there's not a living thing there, just grass. Vast amounts of acreage and industrial complexes. The corporate landscape is nothing but giant lawns. And these all used to be productive areas supporting other species. I hate to say the word wildlife because people always think of deer or coons or something they don't want in their yard.
But people do want birds and butterflies.
Birds, right, yeah.
People do want birds and butterflies. I think that's a very widespread desire. People really enjoy them. And so the problem with all those lawns is that they're alien grasses. They're grasses we've gone out in other places and discovered and brought here, right?
Our lawns are, our turf grass are alien species, but that's not the major problem. The major problem that is in most places where we have lawns, lawn does not want to be there. It wants to be a forest or it wants to be a prairie. And it's difficult to maintain those grasses. We usually have to fertilize. We usually have to water quite a bit. We have to use a lot of energy keeping them lawns in terms of mowing and, you know, putting all that CO2 into the air. But the biggest problem is that what used to be there was a whole lot more plant biomass. So we have removed all of that, those plants, those native plant communities that used to be there, and put in a monoculture of one species. Now, even if that grass was native, it wouldn't be the same as what used to be there. And then the life support systems, or the life, the you know, the food webs that used to be in those areas, completely collapse when you replace it with lawn because it's simply not a functioning ecosystem.
As you talk again and again in your book about the way a functioning ecosystem is an interlinked community and the idea of a food web, and then you also talk about the very, very important role that insects play, which I have to admit, I think we gardeners haven't really grasped or maybe didn't want to grasp, didn't want to think about insects, is really a different way of viewing the landscape, to think about the insects and what they eat and then what eats them. And that was, I think, really kind of a revelation in your book.
Well, that's good. That was exactly what it was supposed to be. But, of course, if you think of the plants in your landscape as strictly ornaments, you want to keep them perfect. You don't want to have little pieces chewed out. Not that it's easy to see those little pieces. Typically, we can look at a tree in the forest, and it looks great, even though every single leaf has given something to insects. But homeowners have always been upset about insects eating their plants, and that's why when we buy plants, we look for ones that are labeled pest-free. And we've successfully created tens of thousands of square miles of suburban yards that have very few insects in them. But if you think about sharing those spaces with other living things, then you need to think about what the role of the plants in your landscape really is. And that is to capture that energy from the sun, but then pass it on. If it holds it, it's not helping anything else. And the best organisms at passing on plant energy are insects. And that's because insects are very good at getting around plant defenses. They do that by specializing on particular plant lineages, and they develop the enzymes and the behavior to be able to break down the chemical defenses that keep most of the other herbivores away. Then the good part about that is other things eat those insects. That's where the birds come in, and, you know, all of our amphibians eat insects. Most of our rodents eat insects. Just really critical parts of complex food webs depend on insects to grab that energy from plants for their own well-being. So if you remove insects, you have simplified food webs to the point where they're extremely unstable and won't exist for very long.
This is WILL AM 580. This is Carol Spindell, your guest host this morning on Focus, and we're speaking with Douglas Tallamy, who's the author of Bringing Nature Home. You know, that brings us around, Professor Tallamy, to the idea of what's native and what's alien. I think this is something people go round and around about.
Right.
Something like Queen Anne's lace. We think of it as part of our landscape. It's been here a really long time. How did it get here? I mean, did it come with settlers, I believe, colonial settlers?
Oh, you know, I don't know exactly for that particular
escaped.
Species.
I think it escaped from their gardens.
There are typically two ways that plants get here. One is through agriculture. So we brought in a lot of herbaceous invasive plants with seed from agriculture, or we brought them over as ag products themselves. Or we brought them over as forage grasses. So a lot of the grasses that are giving the deserts in the West a problem, like cheatgrass and the different brome grasses, were brought over for forage for cattle. The other main avenue for bringing in non-native plants, though, is the ornamental trade. 85% of our woody invasive species in this country are escapees from our garden. And that includes all of the big ones that you can think of. If you're in Florida, you know, that's the Brazilian pepper tree and Melaleuca and air fern and all these things that are taking over the state. In Illinois, buckthorn is a perfect example. So kudzu in the south was brought in first as an ornamental. There are all kinds of examples of our major invasive species that we spend billions of dollars trying to control were actually brought in and sold by the ornamental industry, and many still are being sold. So that's how they get here. But
this is chilling to think about when you read about the history of what we've brought in, the unforeseen consequences from bringing in these plants, and then also the diseases that they've brought in as well.
We lost the American chestnut from our forests in the east, you know, a dominant major contributor to our forested eastern deciduous forests, because we wanted to see what Japanese chestnut looked like in our yards. And that's just not a very good reason to wipe out an entire species like that.
You mentioned the buckthorn here in Illinois, and I believe it brought in the soybean aphid when it came in as well.
It's a host for soybean aphid, exactly. So actually probably didn't bring in the aphid, but it was here. So when the aphid was introduced secondarily, it already had its alternate host. The aphid can't make it without buckthorn, but you've got buckthorn galore. So, but you know, the question of what makes a plant native or not is a good one, because people think if it's been here long enough, it becomes a native. And in one sense, that's correct, but the time scales are very confusing. We look at plants like Phragmites, the common reed here in the east, that was brought over 400 years ago as packing material in ships, and it's an invasive species up and down the east wherever it's wet.
We have it here, too. It's blooming all up and down our roads.
Yeah. You can say, now is that functioning as a native now that it's been here so long? And one way to test that is to look at the number of insect species that can use it productively here versus in Europe where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And in Europe, it supports 176 species of insects. It's a very productive plant there. Here, it's been here 400 years and only supports 5. So our insects will adapt to it, but it'll take tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands or maybe even longer than that. And in the meantime, ecosystems are suffering terribly.
The other problem with these plants that we bring in, we talked about the diseases, we talked about the plants they displace, but they just get out of our gardens, don't they? They're incredibly successful at out-competing native plants.
And I've talked to lots of gardeners who say, you know, I put this plant in my garden, it's still there, it hasn't moved at all.
Hasn't budged.
Right.
Mine is still here.
And what they forgot about is the seed that plant made that was eaten by the local mockingbird, and then the mockingbird flew 2 miles away and pooped it out, and that's how it moves. That's hard to watch, and but that's the way things are moving. A lot of the most invasive plants that we have make berries that birds do enjoy eating. Things like autumn olive is a great example. And they eat them like candy, and then they fly, particularly migrants. Migrants pick up these things, and they can fly 300 miles in a night and then poop out that seed. So plants get around really well. And the ones that are good invasive species are good invasive species because they are so competitive.
Mm-hmm.
They are in this country with the help of humans, and they came without their full complement of diseases and other natural enemies of insect pests, which means they immediately have a competitive advantage over native plants that have a full range of diseases and insect pests. And
But if birds are eating the berries of these imported plants, aren't those plants playing a role in the intricate food web that you describe?
Right. That's a great example or a great question. At a certain time of the year, yes, they can contribute to the bird's diet. But remember what makes more birds. It's insects that birds are feeding to their young. And if you're not making more birds, it doesn't matter what the adults are eating in the fall when those berries are around. Insects are not, or birds are not reproducing on insects or earth. I'm sorry, I get all confused here. Birds are not using berries or seeds to feed their young. They're feeding them insects and other arthropods. So in order to make more birds, we need those insects and not the berries. And there are more people these days that are looking at the quality of the fruit that are produced by different plants. And it turns out in many cases that some of our most invasive plants, things like Bailey Aglis, autumn olive, have berries that are really high in carbohydrates but really low in fats and proteins.
Oh.
Whereas some of our viburnums, viburnum dentatum, I think, was one of the highest that was measured in terms of fat and protein. And that's what the birds really benefit from when they eat these berries in the fall. Otherwise, it's just sugar, and it's, they love it, just like we like sugar, but it's not particularly good for them.
Right, I can imagine. You've got to fly a long way if you're a bird, and you need something serious to go on. Well, what about people, gardeners, who they want to grow something different, so they say, well, this is native, this is a native prairie plant, so I could grow it here in my eastern garden, or this is a native plant from the Pacific Northwest. It's very beautiful. I could grow it here on the prairie. It's a native U.S. plant. So, how would you explain to them? What would you say about that?
I would toss the word native so that it's easier to understand, because what we're trying to do is reestablish food webs in our local areas. So if I take the Colorado blue spruce out of the Colorado Rocky ecosystem and plant it in Pennsylvania, it grows just fine, and it's from North America, but it never was part of Pennsylvanian food webs, which means the plants and animals interacting with it don't recognize it. And it might as well be from Asia, even though it really is from North America. So you're trying to choose the plants that are part of the greater food web in your area if you're going to support the biodiversity that we need our spaces to support.
Well, we hear a lot about biodiversity. I think sometimes it's hard for us to understand when it's in play and when it isn't, because it seems to us that more plants from other areas and they're growing in my garden, that's more biodiversity.
It's more species. It's true. So if you're just counting species, you have more species in your garden. And unless, of course, one of those plants are kudzu. I just came from Mississippi, so that's on my mind, where you drive along the road and the only plant you see is kudzu. So it is so completely outcompeted the native plants that the diversity actually plummets when these things get going. But I understand the concept. If you put in more species of plants, you've got a more diverse planting. That's true. But remember, these plants have to perform their roles in their ecosystem. So if you're putting plants in your yard that are not contributing energy to that food web, then they're not playing the game. They're not part of it. These plants could be silk flowers or plastic, and they would look different. You could give them a species name and say, "Oh, I've got a really diverse plant landscape." But they, then it would be easy to see. Well, they're not part of the living system that's here, and that's part of the problem, the big problem with these plants from someplace else.
So I think the thing that we need to really understand, and maybe is a little hard for us gardeners, is that that insect-plant interaction has built up over a very long time. You talk about evolutionary history, which I think we have a hard time comprehending. And then you can't really change it.
Well, you can't change it in ecological time frames. That's right. So let's use the monarch butterfly as an example.
Okay.
It's a great example of a specialist. And 90% of our insects are specialists, so there's nothing strange about monarchs. They eat milkweeds, and milkweeds in their genus Asclepias, they're actually toxic plants. They're filled with compounds called cardiac glycosides and latex sap that gums up mouth parts. And they're so well defended that very few things can eat milkweeds. the monarch can eat milkweeds because it has the adaptations to get around those defenses. It has the behaviors to avoid the latex sap, and it's got the enzymes to break down and store and excrete the cardiac glycosides. So it can eat milkweed without dying, and that allows it to get access to the nutrients that are in milkweed in a way that almost nothing else can. There are very few things that can eat milkweed. So that's great for the monarch as a specialist because it now has this food plan all to itself. The downside of specialization, though, is that in developing these abilities to eat milkweed, it has not developed the abilities to eat oaks or asters or violets or anything else. And that's the case with so many specialists. They become locked in to what they've specialized on, which means as long as there are milkweeds around, we can have monarchs. But if we mow the milkweeds down along the side of the road or we dig them up or pave them over, whatever, the monarchs will disappear because as a specialist, they are locked into that one particular food plant. So when we go into our suburban gardens and landscapes and we replace the native plant communities that once were there, we're going to lose 90% of the insects that are specialists on those plants because they cannot eat plants from Asia. Now, would they be able to adapt to them over you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of years? They wouldn't, but you know, some insect at some point would. And you would change the entire fauna that exists in your area. But that's what I'm talking about, evolutionary time. It takes a long, long time to do that. But the food webs as we know them today would disappear in the meantime.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up butterflies because a lot of people really do want them in their yards and really do enjoy them. And it seems like one thing that people plant a lot to attract butterflies, and it does seem to work, is butterfly bush.
Mm-hmm. And what they're attracting are the adult butterflies, because adult butterflies are looking for nectar for the most part so that they can fuel their flight in order to fly around and lay their eggs on the appropriate host plants. But that's the catch. There's no butterfly in the East that can eat butterfly bush, Buddleia. So even though it's a good plant for making nectar, what we're doing is we're loading our gardens with a nectar plant that doesn't make any butterflies, which means we're relying on somebody else to make the butterflies with the appropriate host plants. What I'd like people to do is to put both the host plant and nectar plants in their butterfly gardens. And very often host plants for butterflies are woody plants that aren't big flowering plants. Plants like black cherry, it's a host plant to a number of different butterflies that you wouldn't think of as being something important in your butterfly garden. But if you're going to have the tiger swallowtail and the red-spotted purple and the other things that eat black cherry, you've got to have it nearby. And, you know, if you've got woods around or some natural areas, that's usually provided. But more and more we're cutting down those woods, and the natural areas are filled with buckthorn and other things that don't belong there. So it's better just to put it right in our gardens, and then we know that these things can continue.
So that's how gardeners can really play an important role in saving species of our wildlife, you say. But what about people who say, oh, I just have a small garden, you know, I have a very small garden, so I don't think it would really matter what I plant. I don't think it would do any good.
Right. I certainly understand that, and there's no doubt that the more space we use productively with native plants, the better off we'll be. But here's an anecdote that I can give you about small spaces. There's the Department of Ag building in Dover, Delaware, and it has a courtyard. And Dover is the capital of Delaware, so it's in the middle of a city. There's a courtyard in the middle of that building, and the folks that work there decided they wanted to plant a small garden to see what native bees would come to these plants. They were trying to kind of survey the native bees that were still in Dover, Delaware. And this was just a 15 by 15-foot space, so it was not big at all. They planted it with a number of species, but milkweeds were one of them, common milkweed. And one of the people decided that she would count the number of monarch adults that came off of those plants. In other words, they were produced there as larvae in the first year that this garden was developed. You know, milkweed patches kind of grow over time, so this happened very quickly. And after the first year of planning, they got 150 monarchs produced in that little 15 by 15 foot space.
Wow.
When, you know, it wasn't all milkweed. There were lots of other things there, too. So that shows you how productive small spaces can be, particularly for species that can get around pretty well. So I urge people not to give up on small spaces, and particularly if you get your neighbor to do it, too, then it's twice as big as what you started out with. And that's how we can create some really productive spaces.
So we need to think of ourselves, all of us in our suburban gardens, as in part of a cumulative process when all our yards are going to be linked up. And if they're all filled with mostly native plants, then we have created an enormous habitat.
That's what I talk about all the time, is building biological corridors through the areas where we work and we live. And you know, if we get good at it, we can do it where we farm as well, that actually connect the natural areas that we have left. We do have natural areas. We've got national parks and state parks and small little woodlots at the end of the street, but they're all isolated by the roads and the suburbia and the industrial places that we've built. But if we re-landscape those areas in ways that include the native plant communities that used to be there, then those spaces are not isolated anymore. They are actually connected for not everything, but for an awful lot of the organisms out there. And, you know, picture this building these biological corridors throughout the suburban spaces of the U.S., and it will cover an enormous amount of area and reconnect all of these places in really productive ways.
Well, I think now when you go to a garden center or when you go to a nursery, there are many more native plants that you can find at an ordinary nursery, maybe in your area. But what about when they're cultivars? What about when there's more and more choices? You know, they're a different color, or they're a shorter, they're a black-eyed Susan, but they're shorter, or, you know, you see a lot of cultivars of native species now. What do you think about those? Will insects be able to eat those?
You know, cultivars are a marketing scheme, really. The reason we work so hard to make cultivars is because we can patent a cultivar. We cannot patent a straight species. So horticulturists work on cultivars all the time so they can make a name for themselves and also make a dollar for themselves. It's not about supporting more wildlife. The question of whether cultivars are as good as straight species in supporting wildlife is a good one. But we don't have the answer because there's so many cultivars out there and so many comparisons that would have to be made to actually measure that it just hasn't been done yet. I can make some predictions, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It depends on what the genetic change was that created the cultivar. First of all, a lot of cultivars are just natural variants that are found in nature, and then somebody puts a name on them, and then all of a sudden they're popular. But there's one downside to using cultivars, and that is to continue that particular trait, you have to clone it. And we all know that loading the landscape with clones, with plants that are only single genotypes, is not a good idea. If a disease comes by, everything's going to go at once. So cloning's not a great idea. But if you're turning a green leaf into a red leaf, which a lot of cultivars do, mm-hmm. what you're doing is loading that leaf with anthocyanins. It's a chemical that is red, and that's actually a defense against insects. So you're changing the chemistry of the leaf, and you're almost certainly going to affect the specialists, those 90% of the insects that actually develop on that plant. If you're changing the shape of the plant from maybe a fat plant to a tall, skinny one, it may not change the leaf chemistry at all. So the herbivores on that plant might be just fine. Most of the cultivars, though, focus on flowers,
mm-hmm.
and they change the flower shape or the flower size or the flower color. And flower energy budgets are very tight. So if you make petals bigger, it typically does that at the expense of making nectar, and that often reduces the reward for pollinators.
Mm.
And pollinators are also, they use particular plants based on the flower structure. Bees in particular have different length tongues, so if the flower has a deep corolla, then bumblebees can reach their tongue way down in there, and short tongue bees can't do that. So it depends on how much you change the flower shape, about whether or not you're going to affect pollinators just from a morphological perspective.
Huh.
But, I mean, sometimes we change it dramatically. If you've seen some of the cultivars of Echinacea, for example, they look like zinnias. I mean, you can't even recognize them. Why not just buy a zinnia? I don't.
So the concern might be their insects might not recognize them either.
Yeah.
You also point out in the book that if you increase the berry size of berries, which does make the bush more beautiful to look at, that birds might not be able to eat bigger berries.
Well, you know, I've had people tell me that they planted some of these cultivars of Ilex verticillata, for example, winterberry, and they claim the birds don't touch those large berries. I don't think this has been tested scientifically, so it really is just an anecdotal observation. But, you know, it does make sense. If you make it big enough that birds can't get it down anymore, they'll leave it alone. So, you know, we're fooling around with these plant traits just to convince people that this is new, and if you buy it, your plant will be different from your neighbor's, and then you'll have higher status, and that's why we do things. It's all about status. I mean, that's why we have giant lawns. It used to be a status for a status symbol for wealth. And then the whole lawn industry told us we're not going to be good people if we don't have big lawns that are weed free, and we bought into it. So it's all about marketing.
So we can maybe buy into the idea of ourselves as important players in this preservation of wildlife by gardening in a way that values wildlife and that creates spaces for wildlife.
Not only that, but it's a very important component of conservation these days, and it's something that we can see happen. And I know this because I've done this at our own house. We have pulled out all those nasty things I was talking about before. And
that could not have been easy.
Yeah, when I say we, it's mostly my good wife who did this while I talk on the telephone. But we've gotten to see all of the things that have come back to our property, including, you know, the spectacular birds. We had blue grosbeaks nesting in our dogwood trees this year, and all kinds of other birds that just simply weren't around when that was a field mode for hay. I've got lots of pictures of the spectacular insect larvae, particularly caterpillars of moths and butterflies that have come into these different plants as we put them in. And we've only been there 10 years, and these things started coming in very quickly. So I know that you can watch conservation happen right before your eyes if you simply put the food that these things need into your yard. And that can be extraordinarily rewarding and satisfying to watch this happen. There's so many important environmental challenges we have these days, but so few of them that we can actually see results from. You know, we all worried about carbon in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, and we can stop driving our SUVs, and it's the right thing to do, but you don't see any result from that. But if you put a viburnum dentatum in your front yard and you get the hummingbird sphinx moth larva on it, you have created a hummingbird sphinx moth that wasn't there before. It's a beautiful thing, and then you get to see that moth later on come to your Monarda and some of your other plants. So it's a form of entertainment, really, where you're using these native plants as a remote control. You can flick on nature if you want by putting them in your yard, or flick it off by keeping them out of your yard.
And if you have children, they might not have a lawn to play soccer on, but they might grow up knowing the difference between different butterflies or knowing bird species or, you know, being aware and alert, observant about those things.
Right. And of course, there's a big concern these days about how our kids are not out interacting with nature anymore. That's been promoted by Richard Louv in his book Last Child in the Woods, and he's gotten a lot of attention with this, testified before Congress, and so people are interested in our kids, and
mm-hmm.
There's no better way to re-expose them to nature than to put it right where they live. Field trips are great, but you know that's only 1 hour, and then they're not there. But if they can go out and play in their own backyard with something that's alive instead of something that's electronic, this can't be a bad thing. It really can't.
Now, I know a lot of people listening are saying, well, okay, but we want to know what to plant. What should I plant in my garden? And what would you say to those gardeners? Would you say you've got to go out and figure this out? You've got to, you know, find out what plant communities used to be in your area? Or what could they do? Where should they start? You said that you wanted to find this out, and you started counting Lepidoptera. But I don't know if a lot of gardeners are going to do that.
And I know more about these things simply because it's what I do than the average homeowner does. So it's easier for me. But these days we've got a lot of tools that are very helpful. First of all, every state has a native plant society with its own website, and they've got lists and lists and lists of plants that are native to your area. So that's a good place to start, at least for finding out what belongs there. And most states do have very nice books about the plants in your particular area. Then the next step is how do you buy these plants? How do you get them? One approach would be to, if you've got a little bit more motivation, you can actually go out and collect the seed and start it yourself. And for some plants, that's very easy. Things like hickories, things like walnuts, things like all of the oaks are very easy to start from seed. And actually, it's the best way to do it because those things are hard to transplant once they get going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's free. You know, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to use an oak tree because it costs $300 to plant it. And, well, it does if it's 20 feet tall when you put it in. But, you know, an acorn is free, and they grow much faster than you think. I've got some sequential pictures of one white oak that I started from an acorn in our yard. That's already, it's 15 feet tall easily at this point. So you can do that, but it certainly is easier to go someplace and buy it. If you can find a reliable nursery nearby that is either carrying plants native to your area or is willing to get them for you, that's another route.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make sure that they know what they're talking about, though. A lot of times people go in and say, I want a native plant, and the help in the nursery will think that if it's growing in the woods, it's native.
Mm.
So by that definition, buckthorn would be native for you folks, and that's just not the case. So
not
they
a good
have
idea.
Have to have some idea about what you're talking about. And they have to be interested in what you really want and not just making a sale. There's so many nurserymen that will try to talk you into the plants they have because they wanna sell it. But if enough people request particular native plants, that convinces the nursery industry that there is a market out there and they will start to carry these plants. So I'm sympathetic to the nursery industry because they don't want to carry inventory they can't sell, and for the last 100 years, they couldn't sell native plants. So they're skeptical that we really have a market growing out there. But I've talked to enough people, believe me, that I am convinced it's a growing market, and I've heard people call it a fad, and it, you know, that just drives me crazy. How could a plant that evolved here and belongs here and supports all of life here be a fad? I mean, that just makes no sense at all to me. So I think we're getting past the fad of Chinese plants and starting to move into the plants that really belong in our landscapes.
What about the research that you've done since the publication of the book? You said in the book that you're going to try to investigate these things further. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, we've got a couple of experiments that are just winding up right now. One of the things we were interested in was, what if the non-native plant, the alien plant, is actually a close relative of a native host plant? Would the native insect be able to use that plant then?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if we have black willow around here, and if we plant weeping willows from wherever they're from, right next to it, would the insects that can use the black willow be able to eat the weeping willow? Because they're in the same genus. They probably share a lot of the same phytochemistry, the same defensive chemicals. And those insects may be already adapted to using that. So we planted some large common garden experiments looking at this phenomenon. And then we compared them to non-native plants that are not closely related at all. And the bottom line is that we found that even when plants are in the same genus, when they're congeners, the abundance and diversity of insects were cut in half when they're planted right next to each other. So being closely related helped. Half the insects could use it, but the other half could not. If they were not closely related, only a quarter of our insects were able to use them. And those are mostly the generalist insects, that 10% that are not so specialized. So in both cases, we were able to actually put numbers on the degree to which the insect community is knocked down by using plants from someplace else. And why that might be important is, you know, let's go back to those birds. If you're a bird trying to feed your young, and you're out there looking for caterpillars, and you're in an area where there's so many non-native plants that there is only one quarter the amount of food that used to be there, you're going to have to forage, four times harder to get the same amount of food that you used to. And you can't ask a bird to do that because they're already foraging all day long for their young. So the end result is you probably would get just one quarter of the bird biomass in an area that's overrun with these alien plants. So that's why these figures are important, and that's why we're doing that type of research.
So in your book, I know listeners can't see it, but in your book you have actual tables where you might take a plant that we plant that we've brought in from Asia, and there might be 5 or 6 or 8 insects that could use it, and then you compare it to, say, a similar sort of size shrub that's native in that area, and maybe several hundred insects could use it.
Right. We have ranked every plant genus in the mid-Atlantic states in terms of their ability to support caterpillars, the larvae of Lepidoptera. And it turns out that the genus Quercus, our oaks, are number one. They support 534 species compared to, you compare it to other native plants like the tulip tree, Liriodendron tulipifera. That only supports 21 species. So even among natives, there are tremendous difference in the ability of these things to support wildlife. But if you move down to something like crepe myrtle, and I think that supports one, or golden rain tree, supports none. So ginkgo supports none. All these things that we're planting all the time support just a tiny fraction of what our most productive native plants support.
Your work has influenced a lot of other garden writers, and I know William Kalina, who writes about growing native plants in New England, has put forth the idea of scoring native plants. Every plant would have a number, and depending on where you live, you would be able to see which plants are what he calls are the most biopositive. What do you think about that idea?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. I wish we knew enough to do that accurately. A lot of people, I go around and I talk, and that list I just told you about, people want me to make a list for their area. Well, it took my technician 2 years and 4,000 references to come up with that list. So we're happy to make a list for anybody's area, but somebody's got to pay her salary while she's doing it. But if we had that information all over the country, we really could have a score like Bill is suggesting. And I think it'd be very positive step because, people go to the store to buy a plant. They expect the people at the nursery to give them the right information. If there's a little sign there that tells them what they want to know, it'd be a great marketing tool.
It's kind of like those nutritional scores that some grocery stores put on now.
And it directly connects it to what that plant is doing. I have a grad student, Christy Beal, who is just finishing up right now, and what she's done is look at the major landscape trees that we use in this area, both native and non-native, and simply record the migrating birds that use those trees as food stops. And, there's so many birders in this country, so many people that follow migrants, that knowing which trees are magnets for these things could be a very useful tool for marketing them. So little things like that can help us change the landscape.
It sounds easy when we think about it. Don't cut down that oak. Plant that milkweed. Try to make room for that choke cherry.
But it is a departure from the way we've been thinking.
Well, I noticed that oaks are on the top of almost all the lists. And then I guess the other thing is that that's sort of shocking, though, when you go to the nursery, since we're talking about going to the nursery and thinking of what to plant, is that some invasive plants that really get out of hand, are still for sale in nurseries.
It is shocking indeed. The nursery industry is a huge industry. And a lot of people say, why doesn't the government regulate this? Or why don't state governments regulate this? And the answer is obvious. Just listen to NPR every day. These days people hate governmental control of any kind, and top-down regulation is extremely unpopular, even if it's just because it's top-down regulation. Forget whether it's the right or wrong thing to do. So We've been trying the other approach, which is to educate people to realize that this is not what you ought to be doing, and hope that we can change it from the bottom. Now, some states, like Massachusetts, I believe, has outlawed a couple of plants. I know that Oregon has finally outlawed the sale of English ivy. And you know, that's a step forward, except that English ivy is completely invasive all over any place it can grow in Oregon, particularly Portland. I mean, Portland's a disaster with English ivy. So it's way too late to regulate this. But at least they're recognizing that you shouldn't be selling it at the same time. But there's a lot of plants like that are still for sale. Miscanthus, I forget its common name, but that attractive grass.
The very beautiful tall grasses that a lot of people like to grow, yeah.
That's highly invasive, and yet that's for sale everywhere. So
I know they're doing research on it here to use as a biofuel, so it must be very vigorous.
Yep.
Well, it's been really interesting to talk with you and hear about the way you came. I think you have an insect-centric, perhaps, view of the world, and that's really interesting for the rest of us who tend to think insects are something we want out of our garden to hear about.
Yeah. Well, you know, E.O. Wilson once said that insects are the little things that run the world, and if they disappear, we will disappear in a flash. So we need to be kinder to them.
We do, and I think if people want to keep the birds, they want to keep the butterflies, they want to keep all the things that are beautiful, they've got to realize, and I urge them to read Bringing Nature Home, that they've got to keep the insects.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Our guest today has been Douglas Tallamy. He's the author of Bringing Nature Home, published by Timber Press. This is Carol Spindell. I'm the guest host on Focus WILL. Thank you for joining us.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Support for today's programs comes from the 2nd Annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, September 23rd, 24th, and 25th in and around downtown Urbana. The festival features over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music with storytelling and more. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Bossert. I'll be your noon hour host, filling in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. Right now at 11:57, time for a look at the markets. From Kansas City, hard red winter wheat is at 7:46, down 13.75 for December, and March at 7:62.5, down 10. In Chicago, December wheat at 7:13.5, down 13.25, and 13.25. March at 7:56.5, down 8.5. December corn at 4.91, down 4.25. March at 5.03.75, down 4.75. May at 5.12, down 1.25. November soybeans, 10.37, down 5.5. January at 10.50, down 2.75. October soybean meal, 292.50, down 2. December 294.50, down 3.20. October soybean oil, 41.40, down 21. October live cattle at 98.70, up 57.5. December at 101.32.5, down, or rather up 55. September feeder cattle, 111.97.5, up 17.5. October lean hogs, 78.25. That's down 1. And February frozen pork bellies, 106.25, unchanged. With a look at now at the outside markets, October crude oil, 76.02. That's down 78. RBOB gasoline at 190, that's down 54. Dow Jones Industrial Average at this hour at 10,566, down 7. And the S&P, 1121, that's down 370, that's down 4. NASDAQ, 2295, that's down 5. Looking at the forecast for the remainder of the day, once the cold front passes, a brief period of cooler weather will be expected in the Midwest and the East Central Illinois area before warming up again by the weekend. High temperatures today will range from the mid-50s across northern Wisconsin to the low 90s across the Missouri Boot Heel. Overnight low temperatures will range from the upper 40s across central Wisconsin to near 60 along the Ohio River Valley. In Champaign-Urbana, the forecast for the rest of the day calls for mostly cloudy skies, a slight chance of showers, cooler, the high around 75 degrees, west winds 15 to 20 miles an hour, partly cloudy tonight. There'll be patchy fog expected after midnight, cooler, the low 48 degrees, sunny skies expected tomorrow with a high of 78. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow night, the low 58, partly sunny skies on Saturday with a high of 82.